And for those, that is like the opening strings of Carbana Burana, I think. I don't know the hell what the name of it is, but anyway. Welcome to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, on the phone with Mr. Russ Avison, our third week co-host.
That's what we are, third week co-host, huh?
That's what you are. Don't you feel?
Oh, man. I feel kind of insignificant.
Well, you're fine, Russ. You're good.
Thank you.
You're good.
I've been told that.
Yes, I know. And you got the pictures of the snow today.
I did. It's awesome.
Oh, it's so pretty. And it's so quiet when it's snowing, you know. Something you wouldn't know of being down in Fillmore, California.
with all those dogs, no. Especially this time of year.
Yeah, and fire. So, you know, what are you going to do? So anyway, it is, of course, this is our last live show for the year. And of course, I had the honor to be on the air with Russ. We also had the honor to have a new writer with us tonight. Let me give you a short bio of him. He's a pretty interesting guy. He's been a serial entrepreneur, a financial products manager, licensed insurance agent, and professional business consultant and contract negotiator. He has owned a cable TV company, gravel pit operations business, trucking and storage company, self-service car wash, a condominium and luxury home construction and management company, and an energy and mobile phone network organization. Woo! And is the inventor of the Elbow Room to Go, a nifty multifunctional device that millions of airline passengers around the world will be using and enjoying in the months and years ahead. That's where I'm going to stop with him, because I'm going to get him on the air and get him talking. So please welcome to the Writer's Block for our last show of 2019, Mr. Ted Hassan.
Hey. Thank you.
Hey, Ted.
Hi.
What the hell is an elbow room to go?
You know what? For years, it was nothing but a skinny briefcase of mine that I would slide in between the seats on an airplane to kind of own my space for the seat I bought. And then I designed and engineered a piece that was real thin, about the size of a clipboard. It slides down in the side like that and is basically your own armrest.
And
it saves you. Yeah, it's a pretty fun video online to see that thing.
So you don't have to share your armrest with the guy next to you.
You can give him the whole armrest and you have yours too. Yeah.
Wow.
It's cool.
How cool is that for airplane flights?
Yeah, but the stewardess is awesome.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. You're a first-time writer.
I am.
And yes, you are. And apparently one hell of an entrepreneur. But Russ and I have both read your book called Meet the Odds Maker. And it's quite a story. And I hesitated to get into a lot of the stuff that goes on in this novel. Actually, it's not a novel. It's more of a biography. We're just going to ask you some general questions, but I found it fascinating in that you and the Chinese gentleman, Mr. Liu Pai, certainly seem to have a lot going at most of the time in your lives.
Well, I'm glad you didn't say that we have anything in common.
No.
$300 million. And,
right.
I've got good times.
But at least you're laughing about it.
Oh, well, yeah. Got it.
Well, yeah, especially now.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, and your story starts. Well, let's talk a little bit about your cover first, because it's got, your cover is not just a cover. It's like a story in a cover. You want to go through that a little bit, Ted?
Yeah, it is exactly that, Jim. Basically, it is the tale written as hieroglyphics on the mountain sides of the Grand Canyon that are in the waters of Lake Powell, which is sort of the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much you would like me to.
Well, you can get into as little or as much as you want to. I mean, I'm looking at it right now. I'm looking at the hieroglyphics on the one cliff. I'm looking at something about Chronicles. And then there's a guy sitting behind bars. There's some sacks of money. there is like all kinds of things. So you know, explain as little or as much as you want.
All right. Well, the whole story is just like it says on the cover there at the bottom. It's not based on a true story. It is one. Because of that, I had to wait 10 years to put this story public. In order for all the statutes of limitations to run out,
right,
so that the things that come out in this story would not cause me or anyone else any legal problems. So, but I did have I had two main purposes for doing this, and the book would not go away. I'll tell you, it kind of tortured me for 10 years and wouldn't let go of me. And so I finally sat down and did it, because there are huge things that every American should know about that will benefit from it. And that's on, like, that is the, in fact, that particular one is the bag of money up there. That's actually insurance companies, money, who, believe it or not, for the last 100 years have been stealing from widows and orphans.
Right.
And that ended up kind of at the end of my story, which was a big event that came about as a result of what is the more famous part of the story, which is the beginning of what was the debacle of Enron. And I was in the middle of that. So a lot, like I think you said today, I loved how you put that. I never heard that before, but there's a lot of special Easter eggs in this basket.
Oh, that's Easter eggs. Easter eggs is kind of a way of saying there's a little surprises all over the place, you know? But yeah, it does have a lot to do with the Enron scandal. And Mr. Pai, of course, absconded with quite a bit of money. And let's, you know, as you put it, he got the money and I got the jail time. So yeah. you want to go a little bit into that?
Oh my goodness. Well, yeah. Okay. You kind of got it's a progression of events. Now, you mentioned something about Chronicles. It actually, if you look close, it's the Houston Chronicle that is written in the mountainside there. And the reflection in the water is the New York Times. And the reason for that is because the story really gets started with a false story written by the Houston Chronicle about Lucky Lou Pye in the luckiest divorce in history. And the New York Times and Fortune magazine, and you can go online and I promise you can see 100 articles published about Lucky Lou Pye walking away with $350 million because he got divorced 1 month before Enron went to zero.
Right.
Meaning, and so what he told the feds was that his divorce made him sell all his stock. Well, here's a fact that is kind of triggers this whole story. And I happen to be in the very middle of what I'm going to tell you. And that is that he was divorced 9 months after he sold the stock. So there couldn't possibly have been any divorce forcing him to sell all that stock before it tanked. It tanked a month after he sold it all.
So, okay. It's really fascinating. And then I'm sure Russ has something to say about this too. But it starts out with Mr. Pye obsessing over a pole dancer. if for those of you who are listening, and there are quite a few of you, if you don't know what a pole dancer is, ask your mother. I'm sure she'll tell you. But
this is far and away the most successful pole dancer on has ever lived.
Apparently, she's a millionaire. You know, oh my God, this woman is. I mean, she's got Mr. Pie in the palm of her little dainty little hand.
Well, I got to ask you though, is she that good looking?
You know, I think when she was circling that pole, I would probably have to say she was.
So she was at least cute. Now she's a cute millionaireess.
But how that happened is one of those eggs in that basket you talked about.
There you go.
It's a big golden one.
and of course the goose being Lou. Then we have character number three jumping into the fray, which is Lana Pie, who is Lou's wife.
Yep.
Well,
I'll tell you what though. Here's the movie. When, by the way, I think if you looked at the back of the book, there's a guy that is the producer who read it and wants to make a 6-part miniseries out of this based on what I'm going to tell you about this golden egg.
Yes.
Okay.
I did read that.
This dancer, if you can believe it, now she was married too when they first, hooked up.
Right.
And so in the very beginning, I hope this is okay to go over this kind of thing on your show here, but in the very beginning, she and her husband would videotape her taking Lou into a hotel room.
Oh, you can say that. You can say anything you want. This is LA Talk Radio.
Oh, okay.
Speaking of LA Talk Radio, I'm going to break for just a minute. And let's hear a little bit about LA Talk Radio. And, you know, they're the best on the internet right now. And if you're looking for good talk, good sports, good music, try LA Talk Radio. Hey, it's Jim Cristina here for LA Talk Radio. And if you're like me and you love talk radio, but you just can't find anything worth listening to in that pesky little AM dial, then how about this? How about you tune into LA Talk Radio? You see, LA Talk Radio is the biggest and the best in LA and is a .com, so we have it all from sports to music to self-help to, well, just about anything including talk. And right now it's coming right at you. Why don't you sit back and enjoy at www.latalkradio.com. And of course, they are one of our very favorite people. And Sam Hassett, of course, is the owner and operator of LA Talk Radio, along with our great, great, great guy sitting in the control room right now, Mr. Ronan Rosner. And he does such a wonderful job for us because we're all remote. Nobody's sitting in the studio but Ronan. So there you have it.
Actually, I'm sitting on Ronan's lap right now.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Well, that's how you got on the air.
That's how I did it. I love a lot in common with the pole dancer.
There you go. Oh my God, Russ. Anyway, so we back to the story. So of course, Lana is suing Lou for divorce, and everybody wants money. The pole dancer wants money. The pole dancer's husband wants money. Lana wants money. holy crap! You know, I want money, but of course, I'm not involved in this story. So he's going to divorce Lana, and it's only part and parcel to his being able to get the $300 million illegally from Enron. How am I doing so far?
It's pretty good. It's not the bullseye, but it's pretty good.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, things roll around as you're reading books, so
I got it.
Let me ask you though. Technically, Lou Pie did not get the money illegally,
right?
Because he sold his stock. I mean, it was a legal transaction.
Right. He absolutely did. It's just that he told the feds when they wanted to know how the timing was so perfect and that it was a month before it went to zero. He told them that the terms of his divorce required him to sell it all. But that is an out-and-out stone cold lie. As a matter of fact, at the time, and the reason I was in the middle of this is because his wife, Lana Pai, hired me to help her negotiate the divorce with this guy.
Right.
And so one of the key things she had me do, and she wrote the letter, or I helped her draft it, but it was a letter that told Lou she did not want to sell any of her Enron stock, which, I mean, any divorce on the planet, my mom got divorced, and they just cut the DuPont stock in half, and she took hers on down the road, and they both went on down the road with their own stock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was her plan too. She wanted to go away, but Lou knew that if she did, she would have worthless paper. So he sold all the stock and got divorced. Quite a bit later.
Right. So you're convinced that Lou knew at least a month in advance that it was going to tank.
No, hold on. Okay. One day when. When I was I worked with Lana for about 8 months, and one day she got a call from Lou in my office, and she had been complaining about how he was verbally abusing her and mistreating her. And so she said, "Here, I want you to listen to this." And I bent down and I listened to her being berated by Lou, because at that time he had just received the demand that he not sell any of her Enron shares. And he was yelling at her, said he's going to make the decision. And then he calmed down, he got real quiet, and he said, "Lana, I'm telling you, I'm one of three people that knows when to sell this stock."
Huh. The other one was Dick Cheney, huh?
No. Oh God.
Well, you worked with Lana for like between 5 and 8 months, and you managed to get her a lot of money.
Yep. At the end of the day.
Yeah, but then something happened that I don't really want to go into it, but it just suffice it to say that you got into a little bit of trouble for practicing law without a license.
I did. Got to remember, they spent $4 million to try to put me away or send me away. And some of that money went to accusing me of practicing law without a license, which was a real threat to where I was going in this adventure.
Uh-huh.
Meaning I ended up spending well over $100,000 on one hearing that would have shut everything down in the trial that we ended up having. We ended up winning because we proved that everybody practices law without a license. Yeah.
Why not? Well, they do it in prison. I mean,
I practiced law when I was there too.
Well, there you go. And then you got involved with the insurance companies. And as you said earlier on in the show, that you were going after some of these insurance companies that were bilking older people and a lot of people out of their life savings and their insurance claims and everything else. And how did you manage to get into that?
Well, there was a 2-year hiatus. Of course, we're jumping all over the place here. There was a big trial for the services that I performed under the terms of the agreement. That the other thing is real special about this court case, because I'm now kind of a landmark case in that I proved that the state of Texas is the most stalwart, strongest place in the world to do business on a handshake.
Uh-huh.
And I won a $21 million judgment against the Pies for proving a verbal agreement. Now, for the listening audience, I'll share this one thing I put in. One reason I wrote the book was to share this, which is a pretty, I pretty well slammed the legal profession with lots of evidence, as it were, and I support strongly doing business deals on a handshake or on a verbal agreement. And the big reason that when you do that, if all activity and action indicates that you really did have an agreement that sounds like what you're telling somebody, if there's a problem at the end, that it's a whole lot easier to prove a verbal agreement than it is one in writing, because in writing, expensive lawyers can find a problem with any word in that contract, but sure, they cannot in a verbal agreement.
Well, that makes actually perfect sense. So it's kind of like the principle, walks like, talks like, looks like a duck, must be a duck.
100% to a jury. I proved it. Yep.
Wow.
And guess what? That's not good news for lawyers, which is I spent a lot of time in my book trying to be bad news everywhere for lawyers and the court system.
Uh-huh.
I call it the new sheriff in town. I think you may remember that.
Yeah. And so, you beat the odds. I would say that.
Ted, I got a question. A couple things in this book really. First of all, Lake Powell. I love going to Lake Powell. I've been there a lot of times, so that grabbed my attention right away. Mm-hmm. Secondly, in dealing with trying to work the divorce out, all the money that was involved, and Lou Pye with selling his stock, you got all these people getting huge chunks of money. Were all of these people, and including like Skilling and the other people, Enron, did you find that these people are only interested in money and that's the only driving force and to hell with everything else? Because you don't seem like that kind of person from what I've read.
No, I got 22 kids and all here for Christmas. But no, that's not the case. The answer to your question is, I would say, first of all, Lou Pye is the only one who went public to answer that question. When it's online, you can go on channel ABC News, interviewed him and asked him the question. And they point blank said, Mr. Pye, what do you think about, this is after it came out about what he had done. And they asked him, he said, what do you feel about all these people? It was the day all the 2,000 people were leaving and lost their jobs at Enron. He said, what do you feel about all of them? And he looked in the camera and he said, I don't feel anything.
I got $300 million.
Oh, jeez.
Is that brutal?
Yeah. It's like Alfred E. Newman. What me worry?
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Yeah. So, however, honestly, this is not in my book. Ken Lay is in the book there to kind of start the Enron portion of the story. But I would have, in my opinion, the proof that he was ignorant to basically what Andy Fastow and company had done with the phony accountings was that he actually came out of La La Land when he was, he was in what they called Kenny World up in Washington with the president at the time, and came back to try to save the company. If he'd actually known the disaster that was pending, he would have never done that. I'll tell you, he was worth $2 billion at that time. $2 billion.
And billion with a B.
With a B. And he ended up losing almost all of it.
Oh, and he died.
He did.
I would too.
You know the crazy thing about that? Your listeners might be interested in. He lost the trial, right? And they were going to take hundreds of millions of dollars from him. Well, since he died before the appeal was over, it shut it all down, and his wife got to keep all the money.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I read about that because the complaint, or the person the complaint's against, since they're gone, there's no case. There's nothing.
Right.
That's right. If you die, the heirs get to keep it all.
Hmm. I wonder if he died naturally. They said it was.
I think I know he was stressed out of his mind for sure. Yeah.
Well, in fact, they delayed the trial. They delayed the trial because of he had some health problems. I remember.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. No, my pastor, Pastor Ken, and it was a heartfelt time of immense stress where he lost his baby, as well as his, you know, status and credibility and money. I mean, it was a debacle for him, which he had very little to do with. But
I was going to say, do you think he was? I mean, you mentioned a little earlier, but do you think he was ignorant to pretty much everything that was going on?
He was mostly ignorant to what Fastow was doing. Ken Lay, trust me, he would have not understood what he was doing.
And then realistically, how do you recover from something like that? I don't know that you ever really can.
Yeah, no. There's, you know, we all have to recover from something and overcome something in our life. But not many of us ever have to understand life, get to see life as a billionaire, and then overnight you're broke.
Exactly, and then stuff just starts piling on you.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's got to be tough. I'm going to take a few more minutes here and do another commercial. So Hank Tough, don't go away, and we're going to talk about your process and how you got into writing, et cetera, et cetera. But right now, we're going to hear about a place out in Fillmore, California, that is called All Dogs Rule. In fact, the owner is right here in the studio with us tonight, Mr. Russ Avison. And that place has got everything. And I'll tell you what, if you want a place to put your dog, that's the place to go. It's got everything. It's got everything but my dog and snow. So let's hear about All Dogs Rule.
You know, if you're in the Ventura area and you're planning a trip and remember there's no way you can take your canine buddy, how about considering All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover? That's right. All Dogs Rule Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged friends to spend their time away from you. Located on the beautiful Sespe River, if you want a place where you know your buddy will be safe and have lots of attention, being able to play with other dogs, goats, sheep, horses, and even more humans, then All Dogs Rule is the place for you. There's acres of play space, lots of grass, and bountiful orange trees, all with no stress. And a nice list of extras available if you'd want, just ask. So when your dog returns home, you'll have to ask whose vacation was better. Check out their website at alldogsrule.com or give them a call, 805-524-1100. Your dog will thank you.
And, of course, so will Russ Avison. It puts coin in his pocket. And for those of you who don't know who Russ is like a premier famous dog trainer. Well, actually, he's a people trainer. He doesn't train dogs. He trains the owners.
Well, you know, that's very astute, Jim. That's true. It's really true.
I know. You trained me.
Yeah. Well, sort of. You're a tough case.
I was a tough case. But I made it through. My dog is very well behaved.
Oh, yeah. Bella's awesome.
Bella is like the total best dog in the world. Okay, Ted.
Yes, sir.
When are you writing another book? Have you got something else on the computer, or are you just sitting back and luxuriating in all this cash coming forth from this book?
The answer to that question is, first of all, you named a whole bunch of things that I've been involved in, and that's kind of how I'm built. I'm built to get out and go and be active. Writing this book, I got to be honest, it almost killed me. Now, that said, I absolutely had to do it because it was torturing me to be carrying this story around. I knew I had to share it. So the two collided, and I wrote this book. Well, to answer your question, I am living in the middle of what is probably going to be another book, so I would have to say yes.
Okay, that works. When do you like to write? When do you sit down and just start putting words on paper?
Well, so the answer to that question is, just to be truthful, I carried this round with me in my soul for 10 years, like I shared with you. And then I sat down and I locked myself in my office for 2 weeks and I cranked this thing out, the one you read out.
Really?
So I just nonstop. I didn't leave till it was done.
That's impressive.
It is impressive. I mean, I think the fastest I've ever gotten a book done is like 9 months.
Yeah. Oh, well, wait a minute now. So I wrote it in 2 weeks, but I think we edited the thing for a year.
Oh, well, that's normal. You know, that's not unusual.
Okay.
So, but it's a wonderful story. And again, the name of the book is Meet the Odds Maker. And if you're really interested in what went on with Enron and Southern Texas and Ted and Lou and Lana and the stripper, you ought to pick this book up because it's actually a lot of fun to read it, and it goes by very quickly, I would say. Would you? Yeah. Yeah. But
Lou is still married to the stripper, isn't he?
I think technically.
Technically.
Yeah. It's my understanding anyway. Yeah. Oh, they've had their challenges. You know, you had asked me, and I didn't quite get through answering the question you were asking about the bag of money on the.
Oh, yes. On
the cover.
Yeah. I really want to touch on that because there was a 2 year wait, you know, so, and we didn't talk about the big trial, millions of dollars spent on getting the trial between me and my verbal agreement with Lana Pye to get paid. Well, we waited for 2 years for that thing. The jury came back, gave me that award, and we waited 2 years for the Court of Appeals to rule, which I'll share in a minute. But during that time period, I had to do something. And I was in the middle of working with somebody up in Pennsylvania on another business deal. And he got a call from the widow of the recent widow of his partner. And he hung up and was holding his head in his hands. And I said, what's wrong? And he said, you're not going to believe this, but my partner's wife. And by the way, the guy died wrapping Christmas presents for his kids Christmas Eve night of heart attack. Young guy.
Horrible.
He says the insurance company just informed her that they're not going to pay the $1.5 million life insurance death benefit. And I said, you're kidding me. And I'm saying, I've done lots of different things, but I've been in the life insurance business for 40 some years. So I know a lot about what goes on. And he knew it. That's why it was kind of telling me, I guess. Anyway, I said, you know, let's set something up. Let me talk to her. So I met with her, and she explained to me and showed me a letter that they denied her claim because it was 6 months after he'd gotten the policy that he died. This was 2 years down the road now that we're looking back. But
sure,
he died 6 months after getting the policy, and they claimed that he had withheld material misrepresentation is what they called it on his application. And I said, man, get that for me. And let me look at it. And lo and behold, he had forgotten or just not listed a speeding ticket that he had gotten, you know, a year or so before he applied for his life. Well, I happen to know that at his age, $1.5 million would require an automatic inspection by the insurance company at the time of issue to find out on their own. So it didn't matter if a guy would say or remember his speeding tickets or not. Bottom line is, I took her policy. I made a deal with her. And I said, you know what? I'll tell you what. Oh, And she had taken the thing to lawyers, and out of $1.5 million, the lawyer said they would take it on contingency, but at the end of the day, they would probably have to settle for $600,000. She'd have to pay taxes on that because it wouldn't be life insurance anymore.
And oh, yeah, it could be a settlement.
Be a settlement. And so she'd end up probably getting $400,000 6 years down the road.
Jeez.
Okay. She had that. Okay. I said, I'll tell you what. You give me 30 days and 10% of anything I get for you. How about that? She said, you got a deal. For about 2 weeks, I studied everything about the contract and sent an email. And I put this email in my book. You may recall it.
Yes.
But I sent an email to the insurance company, and I explained where there was malfeasance on their part everywhere. And I said, please confirm receipt. They confirmed receipt, and 18 minutes later, literally, they sent an email, said check will be in the mail for $1.5 million.
Wow.
Okay. Now, I'm sharing that story, not for necessarily a kudo, but what happened from that is I realized that there were many people out there with life insurance policies that had been kind of, what do you call, sold. Let's just say sold, maybe less better way is oversold by a life insurance agent, their life insurance agent, on policies, and then would kind of embellish information on those policies to induce the insurance company to issue big face amount for people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and what happens in that scenario often is somewhere down the road, usually several years down the road, people run out of money and can't continue to pay the high premiums. Well, what has happened, and it was all triggered by basically the big weight in the Enron deal, is I ended up kind of perfecting a profession whereby today I help people in 2 week time periods, 3 week time periods to get full refunds, no matter how much money that was ever paid to insurance companies, whenever they were in the same predicament or in some situation where they were oversold. So it's something to pay attention to. And by the way, it is critical for folks. I made a statement earlier, and I have to share this so I don't get in any trouble. I made the comment that life insurance companies, I expose the fact that the big ones, all the big ones, are guilty of literally stealing from widows and orphans. And the reason being, you're not going to believe this. As I was pursuing this profession that I just shared with you, mm-hmm. I discovered that insurance companies do not have to pay death benefits if somebody doesn't ask for it. What happens when someone gets divorced, right? Or say a guy dies and the widow doesn't even know that he had a policy. There's a lot of reasons and a lot of ways that can happen. Forget that. How about parents in a car accident or something? Kids never know. Right? Kids would never know. Well, over 100 years, there's billions of dollars of life insurance benefits unpaid and kept in the till of life insurance companies all over the country. Uh-huh. Billions. So what happens is, with no one making a claim because they didn't know, there's no requirement for them to go out and find heirs that may be due these death benefits. So they just keep them. Well, what happens is, you may not even know there is such a thing, but there is every state has what's called a lost property division in their state. And so what happened was the lost property division of all 50 states sort of came within the same time period that I was uncovering this. They decided that they were going to just make a blanket claim against all life insurance companies for all of the money that I just told you about, that they basically stolen from mostly orphans and widows. And so one thief stole from the other thief, and it's keeping all the money away. So today, orphans and widows have been ripped off. So the way folks can avoid that today is if and when they ever buy a life insurance policy, they just need to put a Social Security number on there for whoever it is they want to need a death benefit, and for contingent folks in case the primary beneficiary, something happens to them too. And that way they then have to run down the Social Security number.
Sure.
Because and give it to those folks.
So right. I've actually gotten notification from the state of California that says we have some property that belongs to you, but you have to contact us to get it. And it turned out it was some stupid little checking account. It had like $80 in it or something, but I didn't know about it or forgot about it. And they said, well, we have the money. If you want to get it, you have to file for it. So yeah. This is the same department you're talking about. Yes,
exactly. Yes, sir. The lost policy divisions. And California is they're so broke that they sued everybody and took a silly settlement from the insurance companies just to kind of get it over with. And bank the money.
Gotcha.
So basically, gotcha. the states ripped off the insurance companies for the money they'd been holding and put it into their own coffers.
Exactly.
Oh man. Hey, the name of this show was The Writer's Block. Ted, did you ever have writer's block when you were writing this book?
I feel bad. I feel like I want to say I did, but in my case, no, because I simply regurgitated real true life. And I just went from one event to the other. And it was, now, was it easy? No, it was not easy. It was very painful. As you know, some aspects of the story are very painful.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Anyway, well, you know, this has been fascinating. We're out of time. So I just want to say thank you for joining us and for staying up late and going to the airport and picking up your 22 kids. And you know, it's been great having you on the show with us, and have a Merry Christmas to you and you know, to your family as well.
Well, thank you very much. Listen, one thing, can I just say, make a little, not a spoiler, but I am not the odds maker, by the way.
Oh, okay.
I don't want folks thinking meet me. I'm not the odds maker.
Okay. Well, the name of your book is Meet the Odds Maker. It's available on Amazon and all the online booksellers. And if you want to give people your email address and where they can find you.
Absolutely. And it is tedahassan@yahoo.com. So tedahassan@yahoo.com.
Excellent. Excellent. And again, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Ted.
And Ted, I just want to say you have the most infectious laugh I've ever
you do. You're
had
really
the pleasure of enjoying.
It's like a giggle.
Yeah, there it is. Funny. There it is.
Anyway, we have I got a break real quick. We're going to be doing another advertisement. We have to make some more money. So thanks again for joining us, Ted. And again, have a wonderful holiday season.
All the same to you.
Oh, thanks, Ted.
Bye-bye.
And for the people who are looking for a publicist and you're having a hard time, how about trying out Creative Edge Publicity? They're my publicist, and they're very, very good. And let's hear a little bit about them. Okay, you've written a book. Now what are you going to do? Well, why don't you give Creative Edge Publicity a try? You see, when Creative Edge Publicity was founded in 2016, they immediately showed they weren't the same as other publicity firms. Like an old pair of shoes or an old friend, they work closely with their individual clients' needs and goals and push harder to get them noticed. Creative Edge believes that communication is an important part of the partnership, and that model is how they have built their success. They collaborate and they work with local, national, and international media outlets and organizations to meet their clients' goals. So Creative Edge, it's your brand, your future. Mickey Mickelson Publicists, and you can find them at www.creative-edge.services. Winter companions, the old
men. And if you are looking for a publicist, you cannot go wrong with Mickey. He is the best. So, Russ.
Yes. By the way, another note. Really nice to have that Simon and Garfunkel on the back of that commercial.
Don't you like that? It's old friends.
I know.
And it kind of fit.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. So, I wanted to wish you and Karen a happy Christmas, a Merry Christmas, a Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thank you. Same to you and Jerry.
Yeah, we're going to have fun.
Bella.
And Bella, and we're hoping it's going to be a white Christmas this year, which is playing out that it just might be.
Yeah, well, I'd sure like to see a picture of Bella in the snow.
When it's okay, well, if I can get her to stay out there long enough, you know, she's a wussy, so she's like getting her little dainty feet wet. But that's I'll get some pictures. Next 2 weeks we are off live. 2020 on January 9th, we have a friend of the show, a personal friend of mine, and a wonderful New York Times bestselling author, Paris Afton Bonds, will be joining us. This will be your second trip into the writer's block, and she's looking forward to it, and we're looking forward to it. And she's actually one of my biggest fans as well, so it's kind of like old home week, and we get to suck up to each other. I kind of like that. So, with that being said, for Russ and for Bobby Jean and myself and, of course, the bookie Jerry and Bella, never can forget Bella, we want to wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we'll be back with you January 9th of 2020. And right now, we are out of here.